Do not adjust your radio dial. This is Where We Live. John Dankosky is not here today. My name is, let me just check, Colin McEnroe. And I'll be guest hosting Where We Live. It's The Wheelhouse. The Wheelhouse is the Wednesday show where we review the news of the week with a dedicated panel of experts. Journalists par excellence in this particular case. John Linder from the Hartford Current joining us. Also, Kevin Rennie, who writes the Daily Ructions blog. That's R-U-C-T-I-O-N-S, Ructions. And is also with me, a columnist on Sundays for the Hartford Current. Ace newsman and children's book author Jeff Cohen filling the third seat. We've got a lot to cover today. A little bit later in the show, we will talk about the curious stagecraft of the announcement that Dan Malloy will run again and sort of what it's been like in the first exciting week of Governor Daniel P. Malloy's candidacy. And, in fact, the entire dilemma about whether to call him Dan or Daniel. We're getting mixed signals, and it's very important to know. We'll also talk towards the end of the show to some people who look at the academic progress and graduation rates of big-time basketball programs. Talk a little bit about where UConn ranks right now. UConn, I think, will improve as things go along. Kevin Ollie himself graduated from UConn, so that's a good sign. But we'll tell you a little bit about that. Towards the end of the show, right now, at the beginning of the show, we will begin with a story that's dominated the last 48 hours of the Connecticut news cycle. About 2 days ago, Lisa Wilson-Foley, a former candidate for Congress in the 5th District in the year 2012, pled guilty, along with her husband, to essentially concealing campaign contributions. But those campaign contributions were monies that were paid to former Governor John Rowland as a campaign consultant. But they weren't paid out of campaign funds. They were paid out of the private funds of Brian Foley's nursing home company. In the documents provided to us by the federal government, it's clear that there was a conspiracy among the three of them to pay John Rowland for work and not have it show up on the, in the documents of the campaign. So, so John Linder, as you combed through these the documents that we got 2 days ago, and you continue to comb through them now, you know, you've been covering this. Kevin's been covering it. Jeff's been covering it. I've been covering it. What did we learn that was new?
Well, one thing we learned is how serious this investigation is, and how something is about to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about possible indictments, possible. Pleas. Rowland hasn't been heard from with his side of this thing. Even on the radio yesterday, his show, he didn't say anything. But I mean, it's outlined here. The government side of it is full of email communications that between Rowland. They don't name him as Rowland, but in court the other day, they dropped all. Well, pretense, everybody just started saying Rowland, Rowland,
I mean,
Rowland.
The federal prosecutor started saying Rowland, Rowland.
Yeah, Lisa yeah. Wilson-Foley was led to do that by the magistrate who pressed her about, you know, what did you do that makes you guilty of this charge? And in the course of that, she mentioned Rowland's name. The prosecutor did. And then Brian Foley, most of all, said, I knowingly and intentionally conspired with co-conspirator one, who was John Rowland. So, I mean, it's all laid out. There are emails between Rowland and the Foleys that say, you know, this is how we should structure the contract. There's an unnamed attorney who they had enter the contract as a party with Rowland, not actually Brian Foley's nursing home chain. And there's frank discussion about writing, structuring the arrangement so that no one would discover it.
Yeah. It's always great when you're reading an email about how something could not possibly be discovered, and you're reading the email, so obviously it has been. You know, Kevin Rennie, watching this whole spectacle over the last couple of days, I reacted to this. I started to think, well, you know, they weren't that interested in bringing Lisa Wilson-Foley and Brian Foley to justice, although obviously they consider that justice and justice is done. This is really about the big fish. And it seemed as though the theater of the last 2 days, in which television stations and newspapers were given some advance warning, as they sometimes are, that this is all going to be unfolding in court, so there were cameras there and all that kind of stuff. It's really about creating pressure, right? They've got a deal in front of John Rowland that they want him to take, and they're telling him the train is pulling out of the station.
He knows the trains. He's, first of all, he's been through this before.
I've heard that.
So he knows. He knows the train station. He knows where the train can go. And I wouldn't minimize the Foleys in their role in this, of course, because to have a conspiracy, you need conspirators.
Oh, yes.
And their behavior in all this is really egregious. Lisa Wilson Foley in 2010 was a candidate for lieutenant governor, came very close to winning a Republican statewide Republican primary. And then she ran for Congress and was a serious candidate. Hard to believe that now in retrospect, but she was. She was a contender. She came close to winning the nomination at the Republican convention. All the time this was going on, she was signing false reports to the Federal Elections Commission. We saw last year in the Donovan campaign finance scandal that the federal law enforcement people treat this very seriously. I think Josh Nassy of the Donovan campaign is going to jail for 28 months.
Yeah, but even seeing yesterday the cameras that were set up in the lobby of my former employers at WTIC in Farmington, looking in through the window at John Rowland, and I mean they're trying to create an environment.
He's next.
Yeah,
he's next, and he was elected governor of the state of Connecticut three times. He did resign, went to jail, and for some reason that will elude all our understanding. For $35,000, has gotten himself into the crosshairs again, and looks like he is in huge amount of trouble.
I'm very shocked because I was under the impression that he'd had a religious conversion, that this was just not going to be part of his life.
My faith in Pastor Will's ability to guide has been really shaken.
Well, one thing I got to say about Monday, they didn't set up. There weren't cameras in front of it. In front of the courthouse. It was all done kind of discreetly.
I did see a Rick Hartford photograph.
Well, we heard about it, but it wasn't like, there was a big effort made to attract media. So what I think they wanted to do was get the Foleys locked in to their story, to their testimony and everything before they proceed further, however they're going to do it with Rowland.
One of the people who started this whole process, who got us to where we are now, is a former FBI agent named Mike Clark, who, not incidentally, was part of the team that investigated John Rowland the first time around. Jeff Cohen, yesterday you talked, as several people did, to Mike Clark. Mike Clark was the one who filed the complaint. He was the one who initially became convinced that something was wrong, that there was some strange involvement of John Rowland in the campaign. Tell us about this.
Yes, so we had a phone conversation yesterday, and Mike was the one who first alerted the feds back in 2012 that he had some concerns about the association between Rowland and the Wilson Foley campaign. And if we have the tape, here's how he said it to me, his recollection of a run-in he had with Lisa Wilson Foley just about the time he sent that letter in.
Song going down.
Oh, no, that's the wrong one. Either we've switched formats, and there's been a rumor that NPR is going country, but my understanding was that wasn't going to be until June 1st, or that was the wrong cut.
Mike's breaking out.
We probably have the Mike Clark cut now.
I still remember I was at a debate in Torrington in April of 2012, and Lisa Wilson Foley came up to me and kind of confronted me at the debate, saying, you're playing politics, you don't really believe this. And I told her, I said, Lisa, I absolutely believe this, otherwise I wouldn't have written it. And then we were interrupted. We never got to finish the conversation. So I guess we finished the conversation yesterday with her guilty plea.
He's quite a storyteller.
To the point of the conversion that you were sort of joking about with Pastor Will and the former governor, I also asked Clark about just the power of the deterrent factor of federal prison, if that has sort of lost its, if it still has the power that it maybe did before, or has it lost any of that? And this was sort of his response to that same question.
The majority of cases, the individual does not you know, make the same mistake twice, and nor is he given the opportunity to make the same mistake twice. You know, in this case, you know, if the allegations are proven, it certainly is incredibly poor judgment and shocking that, you know, the message, you know, wasn't clear.
You know, well, one of the questions that I have, and I don't know whether John or Kevin, you guys have great sources on this. One of the questions that I have, one of the known unknowns, is what charge John Rowland might be facing. Will he be facing basically a mirror image of what the Wilson Foley's faced, or is there something larger? Because if they're trying to get him to take a deal, and sort of the, you know, the sentencing framework around this, if it's the kind of misdemeanor charge that the Wilson Foley's were looking at, is like 6 months to a year or something like that probably. And, I mean, nobody wants to do that kind of time, but, I mean, it's not killer time. I find myself wondering, is there a felony charge that they're holding over him that's a little bit different than what the Wilson Foley's are looking at? I mean, I assume that's something we just don't know right now.
Yeah, I mean, it'll have to be some kind of conspiracy charge. They've alleged a conspiracy for excessive contributions to have been made and to defraud the federal regulators who you're supposed to report contributions to. So, I mean, it might be a mirror image, I guess. But, I mean, conspiracy is a really serious charge, and that could be a felony charge. So, I don't know.
But Kevin, there's always stuff you can lump in there,
there
right?
There are things.
Fraud is a popular one.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, the Postal Inspector Service, they're the ones actually doing the investigation.
I think they could also divide these into multiple counts because it was, you know, it covered various payments, mm-hmm. monthly payments. And in addition to that, I believe that if you are the initiator of the conspiracy, you may face even a greater jeopardy. You know, one of the things that I just wanted to go back to what Mike Clark was saying, and that is in the 2012 campaign, early on, when people heard that John Rowland was making sort of unpleasant phone calls mm-hmm. to delegates, potential delegates who were not supporting Lisa Wilson Foley, it caught people's attention because at this point, nobody thinks he does anything for free. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he was helping Lisa Wilson Foley just didn't make sense that it wasn't reflected on campaign finance reports.
One of the things, I mean, there's several levels to this story right now. There's the level that we're talking about right now, and we certainly are waiting to see how the John Rowland piece of this puzzle gets resolved. Presumably, he and his lawyers, he has a Washington, D.C. lawyer who specializes in this kind of thing. He's represented also up here in Hartford by Bart Halloran. Presumably, there's some attempt being made to craft a plea, an agreement, something like that. Although, I mean, cases do occasionally go to trial, and I suppose that could happen, although I wouldn't recommend it.
Indictments happen, mm-hmm. and then agreements are made later.
Right. But there's also the whole question of his status at WTIC. By the way, if anybody wants to join in this conversation or if anybody has a question or anything like that, 860-275-7266. We cannot promise answers, but we'll listen. 860-275-7266. So yesterday, and these days, radio ratings, of course, are done by these personal people meters, so you can really kind of tell who's listening to the radio. And so yesterday, I assume they got a pretty big ratings bump because a lot of people who hadn't listened to WTIC for a long time were turning on at 3 o'clock to hear whether John Rowland would even be on the air. Although, Jeff, we got a little bit of advance word that he would, right?
We did. It wasn't much of a secret by the time he did take to the air. But then it was, I think, surprising to a lot of people who were listening. Well, for those of us who've followed trials and criminal proceedings before, it is strange to see someone who is, granted, not charged, perhaps we could say not yet charged, but very obviously part of something that is problematic in front of the courts, to be taking a very public seat in front of a microphone, in front of a lot of people, and speaking his mind. It's not something we often see. We can sort of imagine perhaps his attorneys I shouldn't speculate, but it was not something. It's not something you often see attorneys counseling their clients to do. And so then we heard him, and then it got to be, what was it, 3:07. Should we hear the country music again?
Yeah, let's hear that country music, Lydia.
3:07 WTIC News Talk, 1080. John G. Roland here with you. And before I get the program going, I just want to make a quick statement. I am not going to be discussing the recent news and legal developments. I'm sure that you all understand. And I want to respect the process.
Obviously, if you were...
And I paid for those cabinets.
That's right. If he were generally interested in respecting the process, he really wouldn't be in the situation that he's in right now. However, John Linder used to cover the radio business and the TV business, as I recall, many, many years ago.
Yep.
And I worked at that radio station. I worked for the people who run it now. And I would imagine they're very nervous these days, but... I can also picture my former boss saying, it's going to be great ratings today. I mean, one thing they may be thinking about is how far they can play this out. And I mean, a lot of us look at it and say, why isn't he suspended now? Well, one answer might be because this is great relevance for WTIC.
I wonder how those new rating meters are with their precision. I mean, I wonder if they go down to the second. I mean, 11 seconds into that show, it was clear that he wasn't going to be talking about it. But it did seem like everybody was primed to listen at least for a while. I mean, the station has a perception problem. I mean, you know, we've been writing and talking about this, but I mean, one of the things isn't just a legal issue, but it's a question of ethics. When Roland was being paid by Brian Foley, through his company anyway, and his lawyer, he was also on the air just kicking Andrew Rohrabach, an opponent and eventual nominee, but an opponent of Lisa Wilson Foley. And he wasn't telling anybody, his listeners, and not even his station managers at the time, apparently, that he had this arrangement. So, I mean, whose guy is he? Is he the radio stations? Is he an independent commentator on politics, or is he Wilson Foley's guy? You know, just beating up on Rohrabach on the air while the campaign's going on. I mean, the station, all they've given guarded statements saying that we're monitoring it closely. I mean, what's the tipping point between monitoring closely and taking some action? I mean, does there have to be an indictment? I mean, they're not saying.
He was being paid for campaign services, illegal campaign services, and essentially performing some part of those on WTIC.
Mm-hmm.
They should be more upset than most other people that they were dragged into this conspiracy, I assume unwillingly, and yet they appear not to be.
Yeah, I mean, they actually were put in the position of assuring the public at one point that he was not being paid for campaign services. I mean, they made public statements to that effect. And, of course, that turns out not to be the case. What were you going to say?
I have a question just for those of you who've covered this more closely than I did in 2012. Is there any explanation in terms of why Wilson Foley? I mean, it was not an uncrowded Republican primary field. And we know that he went elsewhere for money. Is it to other candidates? But do you have any great insight in terms of how this match got made?
That's a Kevin Rennie question,
sure,
if I ever heard one.
Go for it.
The Foleys, formerly the Fahuys, are really, really rich. And John Roland has always been attracted to very, very rich people because the one thing he never had, he had fame, he had great political success, but he was never rich, and he always was attracted to rich people. And the Foleys, whatever else they may be, are rich.
It's sort of the Willie Sutton answer. That's
and
where
also,
the money was. Because he did ask Mark Greenberg first. He was also
asked Mark Greenberg 2 years before.
To do the same thing.
And Mark Greenberg had
demurred.
Denied.
Yeah.
Not just, I mean, he had said absolutely not. And I think, you know, we should, in all these discussions, we should take a moment to say that in this age of hyper partisanship, I'm not so sure that there are a lot of politicians who would have done what Mark Greenberg has done, which is he has been a appears to have been a very very much a stand up guy.
Well, the two key people in this in the undoing of this are Mike Clark, a Republican,
yes.
and Mark Greenberg, a yes. Republican. This is not a partisan battle. This is an intra partisan.
No, but I'm saying yeah. people on their own. You know, there is a pledge of secrecy and discretion when it comes to some of these things on your own side.
Right, exactly.
And
he went public. Yeah.
And he did. He went public to no benefit of himself.
We have a full board of calls. Let me try to grab a few of them. Here's Wayne in West Hartford. Hi, Wayne. You're on the
Hello.
Air. Hi.
Hello. Hi. I am wondering how journalists with no irony can be contributing so far along to this debate about shutting up somebody's voice. I mean, the First Amendment is the First Amendment. And it is very, very important to journalists. And it seems that we're kind of far down on the slippery slope already with this, just by parroting this question. And I get that journalists aren't supposed to exercise individual judgment over the stories that they, you know, that they report. But if there's anything sacred, anything that requires some sort of judgment on somebody's part who works in the journalistic profession, the idea that you're shouting somebody down off the radio, I think this would be it.
No, you're completely wrong. The First Amendment says that the government shall make no law abridging the right to free speech. Everyone does not have a right to have a radio show when they have used that program in what appears to be quite a dramatic illegal manner. It's just this is news, and you know WTIC may have somehow separated news from talk on their station. But the rest of us don't have to go along with that. We're going to talk about what's in the news. This is in the news.
Yeah, and Wayne, I mean, I assume that you think that other journalists should have covered, say, the Jason Blair situation in the New York Times, right?
Yes. I think you should cover
it. We weren't abridging the First Amendment rights of the New York Times in covering the Jason Blair story. And what we have here is a very similar kind of story in the sense that this man appeared to be using his journalistic mission in a way that was heavily influenced by money that he was getting and not declaring from other sources. So, yeah, I mean, that's what we're covering right now. I mean, I don't know. I haven't personally called to have him removed. I think the only person who's had a call to have him removed from the air is Dan Malloy, the governor of Connecticut. And I guess the editorial page of the Hartford Courant and the New Haven Register have done that, too.
I mean, you just have to be honest with your listeners or your readers. I mean, if I had an arrangement like that where I was being paid by somebody who was a party to an issue I was covering, I either should withdraw from covering it, and that's what I would have to do, or if I didn't, I'd be fired justifiably, or at least tell people what your bias is, what your outside interest is. Nobody's here is saying, you know, calling for him to be removed, or just, I mean, I question anybody who has an outside interest that they don't disclose to the people they're reporting to. I don't know. I mean, you see a problem with that, Wayne?
The Hartford Courant's tweeting around a poll as to whether or not Roland should be on the air or not. And that's participating in the witch hunt, I think, to a greater extent than a news organ should be doing.
I don't agree with you.
There is no witch hunt.
There's witch hunt on John. I've never voted for John Rowland, but I would look you in the eye and disagree that there has never been a witch hunt, specifically when I'm close to Colin McEnroe on this. I mean, you know, being in the same room as Colin McEnroe and to say there's not a witch hunt on John Rowland, there's not a vendetta against John Rowland, and I've never voted for John Rowland, I beg to disagree, and I think everybody's got to look in the mirror on this.
Do you think he should have told his listeners that he was being paid by the Foleys when he was talking about Rohrabach?
I think there's a lot of things he should have done, but the issue at this moment is what we should be doing.
And you say we should ignore it. That's what you're saying.
I'm absolutely not saying we should ignore it. I'm saying we should put out disclaimers. We should talk about the First Amendment, and we should be talking about exactly what I'm talking about, as to what extent do we as journalists start clamoring, start putting up polls as to whether somebody should be fired from their job in a public forum because of something you might disagree with politically. I mean, all this stuff about, oh, John Rowland doesn't do anything for free, that is such speculation. We don't
well,
know that.
Well, we kind of do. Well, anyway, point taken. Let me just – I want to go to a break here because we're running out of time. We've got a lot of calls here, so we'll stay with this issue a little bit more. I'm just going to wrap it up just by saying a couple of things. One of them is, of course, that broadcast outlets are a little bit different. They're publicly licensed. Back in the day, they had greater accountability and responsibilities for their behavior than they seem to now. But they're still publicly licensed entities. I can tell you also, having worked for that particular company, that particular station, that particular time slot, that you have to fill out you have to read the business conduct code of the corporation. You have to sign a statement saying you've read that code. I put the code up on my blog yesterday. He's pretty clearly in violation of a bunch of those things. But I think also, just to the point of the current poll about this, you know, whether it's a good idea or not, I think one of the things they're taking people's temperature about is this is a very, very old radio station with a very long, complicated legacy. And for many years, it was just kind of, you know, it was really sort of in the golden age of radio. It was a network radio station that carried all kinds of, you know, kind of Arthur Godfrey kind of programming and stuff like that. It's been many different things over the course of its existence. Only recently did it become a completely conservative right-wing radio station. And I, you know, just in terms of the mail that I get and stuff like that, there's a lot of people who feel as though they've lost something. They lost TIC as a more diverse source of programming. And maybe that's sort of part of the poll too. I mean, the bigger question in the poll, obviously, is this man seems to have behaved dishonestly. Should he be suspended at least until all this is cleared up? I think it's a legitimate question. Anyway, we do have to take a quick break. We'll be back with John Linder, Kevin Rennie, Jeff Cohen after this. All right, we're back. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Colin McEnroe, sitting in for John Dankosky. I'll be back on the air at 1 o'clock today. We'll be doing a very different show about subatomic particles, specifically the Higgs boson. Now they've found it. How come you can't get it in shampoo? I think we'll be asking deeper questions than that as well. And I may also be on WTIC at 3 o'clock today. Who knows? Anything can happen. So we're talking with John Linder from the Hartford Current. Read his column this Sunday. He doesn't know if you can tell us yet what it is.
I don't know what it is.
Well, I didn't want to be the one to say that. And Kevin Rennie also has a column coming out this Sunday in the Hartford Current. Also check his blog, Daily Ructions, for some of the latest breaking news. Jeff Cohen, ace newsman and children's book author, is also with us. We do have a bunch of calls here. Although we sort of had planned that we would be moving off this topic by this time, just because of the volume of calls, let's take a few more and maybe we can play this into our next topic here. Here's Michael in West Hartford. Hi, Michael. Sorry you had to wait.
No problem. Hi. I'm fascinated by this story, and you know, I don't buy at all that it's a First Amendment issue whether or not John Rowland's on the air. The issue for me is that I kind of feel embarrassed every time I hear him referred to the Gov. And you know, I used to listen to TIC a lot, and now I just tune in for the news. I wish there was more on the station that I wanted to listen to. My question is, though, has to do with his value to the campaign, the Alicia Wilson Foley campaign. You know, I understand he had influence as a broadcaster, but are there other ways in which he was valuable?
You know, this is also a good Kevin Rennie question, but we're going to start with over here with John Linder, because one of the things that we got from the federal government 2 days ago was kind of a document dump that, I mean, a lot of times the answer to Michael's question would be highly speculative, like who really knows what he's doing for the campaign? Well, we kind of do know what he was doing, but at least we have now emails, we have dialogue, we have conversations going back and forth between not only John Rowland and the Foleys, but also with Chris Healy, who was playing essentially a managerial role in that campaign. We do know what John Rowland was doing for the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, his value besides being a broadcaster, I mean, he's from Waterbury. He's one of the most influential Republican politicians or politicians of any stripe from that area. He knew a lot of people, and they were used to listening to him. I mean, he has relationships with them. So if he calls, as Kevin mentioned, if he calls a delegate, if he calls a town chairman, I mean, these are all people he's known for years and years and years. He's probably helped them in the past. I mean, that's real value.
And Kevin, even at the time, as this was unfolding, you were reporting on activities that he was engaging in.
Yeah, that he was calling delegates, and he was being unpleasant when it would turn out that their town committee went for someone other than Lisa Wilson Foley. And I think that that Lisa Wilson Foley and probably Brian Foley, who's not that involved with politics very often, that they perceived him as someone who could deliver delegates. And it was at that time, it was a delegate fight. And I'm sure that he showed them how and where and who he was close to, and they believed him.
Let me just grab one quick call here from Gregory, and then we're going to have to move on here. Hi, Gregory. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Hi, Colin. This comment is actually really for John Lender. I commented on his Facebook page recently. I guess my big question is, why are we surprised? We have an individual who has over a protracted amount of time proven to be nothing more than who he is. And so in saying that, I mean, you really got to look at this thing. If you knew that the neighbor's dog had a potential to bite you, why would you go over and pet him? So, you know, I don't understand the understanding of who this man is. I mean, how is he perceived? I can tell you, he robbed a lot of money from me and changed my life irrevocably. And, you know, circumventing early on in his tenure as governor with the state state disposal surplus property bidding process. Denny Williams had covered that pretty well. And if you want to read up about that.
All right. Well, yeah, that is sort of is kind of water over the bridge or the dam. It's under the bridge or over the dam. I want to move on here a little bit, although, Jeff Cohen, you made an interesting point during the break, and I'll even expand on it. There's actually two people who have to do some work right now to clarify who they aren't. One of them, I would think, would be the chief of detectives for the city of Hartford. Maybe that's not his exact title. But his name, I believe, is Brian Foley.
That's right.
and the other one would be a candidate for governor, right?
That's right. Now, I'm not as in deep as this as Kevin or John, but you know, as a spectator looking in, you have to wonder whether or not this makes Tom Foley, if not Brian Foley, but Brian Foley's not running anything, as far as I can tell. Tom Foley, a little bit nervous just by guilt by a name association. I don't know if that's relevant. I also don't know that we as an electorate are a whole lot more discerning than that to not get either confused or turned off in any sort of subconscious way.
People don't follow politics as closely as we do, obviously.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and Foleys who were in court the other day, they're wealthy and prominent, but they're not statewide names. I mean, if I were Tom Foley, I don't think I'd be too worried about it. And as the campaign gears up, I mean, everybody's going to know who he is, and his face is going to be on TV all the time. I mean, it is interesting. When I'm writing, you know, I constantly make sure, because I write the name of Tom Foley a lot, you know, I just have to make sure that I don't slip.
Yeah. Put it on one of your function keys so you get it
right. Do we have those anymore?
Well, you know, we should just take a little moment to talk about the announcement that Daniel Malloy, was running for governor, which happened last week. It didn't really happen the way announcements like that happen, right, Jeff Cohen? I think we'll all remember where we were when we heard that Dan Malloy was running for governor, except maybe Dan Malloy. He might not remember because it was like, I was at a bond thing or something?
Yeah, it was one of those bond commission meetings where the state bond commission, of which he's the head, approves funding for various projects. And this was sort of like paving of some public parks in Litchfield. And then, you know, and then he comes out and he takes questions from the press. And at the end, he just decided that this was going to be the time that he and Nancy had talked about it, and this was going to be the time that he announced that he was going to make a second bid for it.
Did this strike you as surprising, though? I mean, obviously there's a disincentive to call a lot of attention to the fact that you're running, because then people just say, well, you're just a politician. Although, as we all said here last week on The Wheelhouse, everybody already thinks you're a politician. But did it surprise you that he just kind of let it drop that way?
No, it didn't. No, not as much as it surprised you, okay. I think. And one reason is last weekend was a very, very big local news weekend with the UConn games. And so I believe that your audience for the consumption of news last weekend was at a very high point, maybe a peak for this time. At least we thought so, and maybe bigger this weekend. But it was a way – and then as I see their fundraising emails – they're really, really trying to latch on to the UConn basketball team's successes. And so it did seem to me that appeared to be a time that would be to some advantage. You're not going to get, you know, there aren't many opportunities to boost your announcement that you're running for a second term as governor, because everybody knows it. I mean, sort of the head of Northeast Utilities sort of let the cat out of the bag with his illegal fundraising letter.
Well, there were many signs that, and John Linder, one thing that was clear was once the switch was pulled, they had built Six Flags. The rides were all ready to go. I mean, there was a campaign that had been built and was in place.
Yeah, I mean, there are all these emails that are coming up on my screen, and I've just been too busy the last couple of days to open them up. But, I mean, it's from Kathy Malloy. It's my birthday. And every other possible personal connection. Somebody sends a thing, and, hey, you know, he's running. Give us money. I mean, the thing with why he chose to do it then, at this point, his candidacy for governor, I mean, everybody knew it. It's kind of like a couple who's been living together for like 8 years, and you ask your friend, are they married or aren't they married? I don't even know anymore. Well, that's the way it was. That's the way it was with Malloy. And here was a moment that maybe he could make a little bit of a splash. Oh, look at this. He dropped it. It's a surprise.
I think it also fits his I'm the incumbent narrative and I got to get back to work. That's just something that we hear him talking about a lot, which is, you know, I don't have a whole lot of time for this politics stuff. So I'm running and now let's get back to work.
I mean, to Kevin's point, we did receive an email. People who are on the email list, which would be people who might be persuaded to give $5 or more to the fund drive right now. It says, it's game time. Before you watch UConn take down Michigan State to advance to the Final Four, can you stop by our team's website? I'm proud to be on Dan Malloy's team, and we're building something great, but we won't be ready for the big game in November without you. Can you come off the bench and make a contribution before tip-off? Enjoy the game, and go Huskies. And that was from his communications director.
How could you say no to that?
Right.
And then there was the next morning by Kathy Malloy saying, wow, what a couple of days it's been for Connecticut, citing UConn basketball again, and her husband's announcement. I'm waiting for the Earl O'Garrow fundraising solicitation.
I was amazed I didn't get one saying, before you watch the finale of How I Met Your Mother, how about meeting us in cyberspace for, you know, a $5 contribution? I mean, the emails have kind of gotten like that. And you sort of wonder at a certain point whether this will become sort of more annoying than anything else. But in some ways, the timing has worked out very nicely for Dan Malloy. I mean, he's not making a huge deal out of this, but he really does have an opportunity right now to, even though Tom Foley, none of his opponents are kind of involved in any of the John Rowland, Wilson Foley stuff. It's kind of a nice moment to be on the other side of that political fence anyway. And I assume he'll make some hay out of it too. Anybody?
I assume, you know, yes. they had, as someone pointed out, I think in the Waterbury paper, they've had and sort of an up and down relationship, and I think might be a good moment to say that it's not just Republicans who were going on John Rowland's radio program. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a couple of months ago a bizarre guest appearance by the Attorney General George Jepson, which they talked about a case in which John Rowland is a defendant and George Jepson is defending the state. And it was right there for the whole world to hear.
And I also wonder if that tips off a little bit of the political strategy of the Republican Party in the coming months. I mean, it'll be interesting to see who they go after, who among the constitutional officers they make a serious attempt to unseat. I mean, there seem to be some pretty serious candidates for treasurer.
Yes.
And possibly for Secretary of State. I'm not sure they're going to really make invest a lot of money trying to get George Jepson out of there.
But you don't have to invest a lot of money. You have to raise $75,000 in small contributions.
True. Anyway, well, it'll be interesting to see how those races unfold and who gets targeted and who doesn't. And, you know, if we have just a few seconds here, and I think we do, one other thing that happened here in all of the hoopla over politics and basketball and corruption and stuff, you could almost miss the fact that Jeff Cohen, the deadline for healthcare signups arrived. And so how the state has been held up as a shining beacon of how to do this, how to make Obamacare work. So how did we clock in here at the end?
So how does it work is a hard question to answer, really. The one metric that everyone's looking at now, is gross enrollment. And Connecticut did fairly well. It enrolled about 198,000 people. in Obamacare and various insurance programs. 76,000 or so were actually enrolled in private insurance. The remainder were enrolled in Medicaid. By contrast, nationwide, the federal government hit its 7 million mark that it set for itself. There are a lot of outstanding questions, though, right? Do all of these people pay all of their premiums and stay insured? Is their coverage actually affordable as promised by the name of the law that enabled it? Are the networks broad enough such that they actually are reliable places for people to get medical care? So it was a huge deadline. But I think people are wary – people who are looking at this from a policy perspective are wary of the various deadlines that have come and gone with the law because it's I think from a policy perspective, it encourages people to look at this as a sprint and to start gauging it on a month-by-month basis. And if you take the long view, which is what I think the president and his advisors are probably hoping for, success is a much longer goal.
Also, how many people had their insurance canceled mm-hmm. under the act, and then were essentially forced into the Affordable Care Act?
And if I didn't say it, how many of those who are now insured were previously uninsured? This is right. The idea is not to just shift people from one program to another, but to actually cover more people who were previously uninsured under our existing medical program.
We could discuss this at great length, except we can't discuss this at great length because we're going to run out of time for the final segment. So we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be back in just a second with a different topic. And we're back. This is The Wheelhouse. Jeff Cohen is here from our own news department, and Kevin Rennie from Daily Ructions and the Hartford Current. From the Hartford Current, also from Government Watch. That's what it's called, right? Government Watch.
Yep.
Yeah, Government Watch. John Linder here. Over the weekend, obviously, the other really great news was that the UConn Huskies are going to the Final Four. I've sort of been out of communion with the Huskies a little bit just because so many of the things that happened towards the end of Jim Calhoun's tenure as coach were the kind of things that I don't like about big-time college basketball. But Kevin Ollie has given a lot of us new hope. He's running a different kind of program. He himself, on the academic front, managed to graduate from University of Connecticut in 4 years. That's encouraging. Clearly the university, badly burned by its poor academic performance, which actually made it ineligible last year for postseason tournament competition, is trying to do a much better job. So I got interested in the work that comes out every year, the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports, sometimes known as TIDES, at the University of Central Florida, releases a study on the graduation success rates and the academic progress rates of these teams. And then they kind of update it as the tournament goes along. And so as we got into the so-called Sweet 16, they issued sort of new rankings of the 16 teams that had made it to the Sweet 16. Now, dispiritingly, in both categories, graduation rate and academic progress, UConn was dead last. It was 16 out of 16. So Dr. Richard Lapchick is joining us right now. He is the director of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports, a chair of the Sports Business Management Program at the University of Central Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, one of the things, I mean, looking at this study, UConn's graduation rate is 8% in your numbers, and the next worst number is 44% for the University of Wisconsin. Most of the other teams are doing substantially better, with the University of Dayton at the very top at 100%. What time period does this cover? Because obviously here in Connecticut, we're very hopeful that Kevin Ollie and kind of a new wave of academic management is going to make UConn basketball better. So what time period are we looking at in the numbers that you put out?
The time period for the graduation success rate is student athletes who have been out of the university system for a year and a half now. So they are not current student athletes at all.
Mm-hmm.
The academic progress rates are the snapshot of the current student athletes. And your listeners should know that in terms of academic progress rates, they publish them late. So there's a new batch that's scheduled to be published in a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding from the people at UConn, and I don't think they would tell me this if it wasn't accurate, is that they're going to have an extremely high APR rate. they said as high as 1,000. They said they've already seen the scores, and I know the NCAA reveals the scores to the schools several months in advance of the actual publication. So that would be a very positive sign of the current team and its future at UConn.
Yeah, so if it were 1,000, that's a very high number, right? I mean, UConn's number in your study is high 800s. Most of the teams are somewhere in the 900s.
Right. I think there were two men's teams with a score of 1,000 in the tournament of 64.
Yeah, so that would be, that'll be great. That'll be amazing. One of the things I think a lot of people – go ahead.
And I also – if you don't mind my saying, sure. I'm also – I've known Ward Manuel, your athletic director, for 20 years or so, and he's one of the people in higher education that I admire most, and I know his passion has always been for the student-athletes. So I don't have any doubt that there's going to be – has been and will continue to be a big push to improve all of the rates.
And Richard Lapchick, obviously we look at that 8% number, that 8% graduation rate, and it's a horrifying number kind of no matter how you slice it or what time period you put it in. But I think a lot of people have questions about also how that's measured. Specifically, you know, we look at a team like Kentucky that is mostly freshmen, and we assume many of those freshmen will not be around 4 years from now, that they'll go on to other things. So how does the graduation rate get measured? Does it count freshmen who jump into the NBA? Do they get counted as non-graduates, or how does that work?
If freshmen leave in good academic standing, then they are not counted against the graduation rates. If they leave in poor academic standing, then they would count against the graduation rates. One of the very negative things about the so-called one-and-done rule is that, and I'm not saying that Kentucky does this, but schools could put their freshman student-athletes, knowing they're going to leave in the middle of the spring semester in a group of classes that they know would be very difficult for them not to have good grades in, so they'd be eligible for the second semester. So when they leave, at the, let's say in April, make the announcement they're going to the NBA, then they would have left in good academic standing, and then it wouldn't count against the graduation rates.
And moving away from UConn for a second and just sort of looking at the bigger picture, I know the other thing, or one of the other things that you look at, is the gap between graduation rates and academic performances of white athletes and black athletes. As a general matter, how is that? What's the trend on that?
The trend is to have substantial disparities between the graduation rates of African Americans and white players. It's the most disturbing part of the release because graduation rates in general are continuing to climb, but not in this particular case. But in the Sweet 16 group, the gap between blacks and whites was 55%, even wider than the 23% I think among the 64 teams. And for me, I have called for the NCAA to include, as part of their academic progress rate measurement, the disparity between African-American and white student-athletes. I think that would be a tremendous incentive to schools to make sure those percentages also go up.
All right. Well, listen, Richard Lapchick, thank you so much for joining us. Richard Lapchick is a director of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports and chair of the Sports Business Management Program at the University of Central Florida. So how many of us are predicting UConn to make it to the championship? It's getting very quiet here.
Well,
do they beat
Florida? They did beat Florida.
They beat Florida once, yeah.
Earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, they got a shot.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have a 7 seed and an 8 seed in the final?
It would be great, right?
It would be historic, I think, wouldn't it?
Does this mean your bracket's in really bad shape?
My bracket collapsed on me, and I had to spend the weekend on the couch.
Yeah, I'm dead, too.
Yes.
I'm dead.
I think I have Florida winning, but it has been remarkable to see some of these surprise results.
Right, and UConn really has been fun to watch. We have to wrap here. I want to quickly mention we are doing a forum on sports. It's called How Do We Get Back to the Field of Dreams? It's at Watkinson School at 7 p.m. on April 9th. Please come and join us. We'll be doing a show from there, too. Thanks to John Lander, Kevin Rennie, Jeff Cohen. John will be back tomorrow. I think you'll all be very relieved.